Okay, well, thank you very much, Benoit, and thanks for inviting me to come here to the Fields Institute. So I certainly look forward to, you know, being part of this program today. And as you can see from the title, what I'd like to cover here has to do with mathematical approaches to something that has been labeled in a way, not really by us, but by a number of process industries, as enterprise-wide optimization. So, first of all, I think the question is, what do we exactly mean by that, or what is meant by that? Well, I think as you can see, enterprise-wide optimization really involves optimizing operations that start all the way from upstream, like at R&D level, material supply, manufacturing, down to the distribution level. And of course, as you can also see, there's a number of multiple objectives: reducing costs, maximizing profit economics, reducing inventories, improving asset utilization, or improving responsiveness. So obviously, we have multiple objectives here. And just to give you an idea about this area, what I've done here is just simply to list three publications in case if you're interested. This paper in AICHE Journal was sort of motivated by the session that there was at AICHE meeting, you know, trying to scope, you know, what is the interest in this area. I do have to acknowledge the fact that actually the term, the first time I heard it was actually at ExxonMobil. At ExxonMobil, they were really dealing with supply chain problems, but they did not like the term supply chain, in part because supply chain sounded a little bit too much like Amazon or Walmart. So they said, no, we are a manufacturing company still, so that's where it came from. So there's also this paper by Retitis and his group at Purdue. That's a somewhat more recent overview. And we also, together with Kevin Furman from ExxonMobil, had a special issue in computers and chemical engineering. So again, I just offered that in case you know you want to find out a little bit more about the area. Well, where does it arise? Well, if you look at the petroleum industry, the corresponding supply chain is actually very long, very complex. It starts here at the level of the wellhead where we're producing the petroleum, we're extracting it. Then you have trading, you transfer the crude, and of course the heart of the entire system is here at the refinery, where hopefully we're performing optimization and so forth. And part of the products that come out from the refinery is, of course, the gasoline for which you schedule the production, you do the transfer, and finally you deliver it at the level of the pump. And the main point here is if you look at a system like this one, it's very clear again, this is a very large supply chain, it's complex, it's also highly dynamic. But the main motivation here is the fact that the sheer volume is such that optimization can clearly have a huge impact. Even a few percentage points of improvement can translate economically, for example, in truly billion-dollar savings. Now, another type of industry where this type of problem arises, for example, is the pharmaceutical industry. Here, however, what you have at the front end is really sort of the R&D level, which is basically dealing with the development of new drugs. So here you have the discovery of potential targets for new products, you have the preclinical trials, and you have the usual various phases of clinical trials, and if hopefully that drug or molecule, you know, is approved because it passes all the tests, then you go into this life cycle management, which you then have to coordinate together also with the design of how you're going to build the facilities to manufacture that new drug and how it's going to be distributed on a global basis. So as we can see, these are sort of two different types of applications where this type of problem will arise. Now, conceptually, what are the key issues? There's sort of, I would say, two main issues. On the one hand, there is the issue of integration. Integration in the sense we're dealing at the high level with planning type of problems, intermediate level scheduling, and sort of at the real time level with control problems. And a conceptual problem that we have here is that we have multiple type of models. Planning, these tend to be linear, mixed integer linear, sort of aggregate type of models. Scheduling tends to be more detailed, typically mixed integer, either linear, nonlinear. And then control, we have the real-time optimization, model predictive, typically sort of dynamic optimization type of problems. And conceptually, a problem here has to do largely with the fact that we're dealing with multiple timescales. Planning, we're looking at months, years, and decisions are largely, you know, driven by economics. Then you look at the scheduling level, and that's now shorter term, typically days, maybe a couple of weeks, and a lot of it is to do with feasibility of the delivery of products. And of course, you go to the control level, and we have even a smaller time scale here, seconds, minutes, and we're dealing with the dynamic performance. So the question is, you know, how do we integrate systems that are operating over these different timescales? But another important challenge that there is here is sort of integrating the modeling and solution methods for these type of problems together with information systems. And here the slide I have is from Sridhar Tayur at Carnegie Mellon, who's actually sort of well known in the area of supply chain. And the way he has the view, it's, I think it's kind of interesting in the sense it has this lower layer that is called the transactional IT, where the sort of the heart is the enterprise resource planning system, where you're taking external data and translating that into materials requirements on the one hand, and on the other hand, on distribution requirements. And basically, sort of the systems here, the typical SAP, Oracle, you know, type of systems, you know, with which you're trying to, you know, make decisions. And now, one of the big changes that there has been, of course, that, you know, everybody has access to information, so it is possible to really start to think of looking at these very large systems. But of course, it's not enough to have these transactional ITs. What you want to have is this sort of upper layer that he calls the analytical IT. Analytical IT refers now to a set of optimization models, starting with the longer-term strategic optimization modeling, intermediate to tactical optimization modeling, and then on this side, dealing more with the production side, both the planning and the scheduling, and on the other side, more with the logistics and the distribution. And again, the whole idea then here is in order to develop some of these models in order to support the activities and decisions that are made with these tools at the transactional level. Now, the question then here is, what are the challenges, what are the issues that are arising these problems? Well, clearly, first we have the modeling challenge. We're looking, as we've seen, at risk levels, planning, scheduling, and control. And I would say increasingly what is happening and what we foresee happening is more and more the need of handling nonlinear process models. We're moving away typically only from linear models. Another important challenge that we've also seen with the previous slide is what we call the multi-scale optimization. We have on the one hand large systems that are geographically distributed over multiple sites on the one hand, but we also have the time dimension as we've seen, where we want to integrate decisions that are long-term, years down to, you know, seconds and days that are basically operational. Then another very important challenge that we have here is the challenge of how to deal with uncertainty, because especially as we're looking at the longer term, as you can imagine, there's a lot of uncertainties with demands and so forth. So how do we handle those? Now, these are largely, I would claim, sort of modeling challenges. And of course, you know, they are by itself, you know, very difficult to address. But even if we address the modeling challenge, that will not be enough, because the fourth one is really the one that will make the deployment and implementation of these models possible, namely how we overcome algorithmic and computational challenges. Why? Because many of these problems are truly large-scale problems. And on the other hand, often when we go especially to nonlinear problems, these tend to be non-convex. So the need for developing efficient algorithms that exploit modern computer architectures is absolutely key. So I would say this should give you hopefully sort of a map of what the main challenges are. Now, at Carnegie Mellon, what we have this Center of Advanced Process Decision Making, within which we have this special interest group called Enterprise-Wide Optimization. And sort of the idea here has been to say, well, if we're going to face these challenges, what we really need is, first of all, to have a multidisciplinary team. And so we have two chemical engineers, Larry Beaver and myself. We have people from OR, like John Hooker and Nick Sicomandi, people from industrial engineering, also from both Lehigh University of Pittsburgh. But what's actually driving this whole effort is really, you know, the contributions from the eight companies that I'm citing here, because the whole approach we have taken is to say, well, this is an area that we need to understand. So the first thing that we really need to do is we'd like to get, you know, problems for some of these companies that we can work on to try to understand what the issues really are. And it's in that spirit that I'd like to present basically three example problems. The first one is actually an interaction we have with Dow Chemical. It has to do with tactical planning and production scheduling. And as we're going to see here, conceptual problem is really how do you get one for, you know, solving a very large mixed integer linear programming problem. The second application I'm going to present, actually we have not had directly initially interactions with a company, but I decided to include it because it deals with stochastic inventory management, where the big issue is not only the fact that we have to contend with a mixed integer nonlinear program, but the fact that it's non-convex and how we find global solutions to that problem. And the third one is an interaction we've had over a few years with ExxonMobil, looking at the design of offshore platform, offshore facilities, where the big issues, again, are accounting for uncertainty. And this third applications will give you some ideas, some insight into the use of stochastic programming. So let me start with the first application, the integration of planning and scheduling. And so here, the issue is more or less like the following. So as we mentioned before, when you look at planning, you're looking at longer-term horizons, and scheduling is at a shorter term. And as we also mentioned, the models tend to be different. So what has been done typically is to use this sort of hierarchical approach where you say, well, I'm going to make some decisions at the planning level, maybe pass some signals in terms of targets of production to the scheduling level, that then we'll try to implement them. Now, what happens here very often is that there are mismatches because, of course, the view or information that the planning level has is not detailed enough. So when scheduling tries to implement it, you may find that it's not feasible, or you may even, you know, have extra capacity. So mismatches is a big problem. Now, conceptually, the way to get around to that problem would be very simple, would be to say, well, if we want to eliminate absolutely the mismatches, why don't you consider the entire horizon, okay, on which we're going to apply our detailed scheduling model. And that way we're doing, if you wish, simultaneous planning and scheduling using, if you wish, the lower, you know, granularity type of model. Now, that is fine in terms of eliminating the mismatches, but the problem is very clear that scheduling problems, as you probably know, these are NP-hard problems. And when you try to extend them from maybe 1 or 2 weeks to something like 1 year, they're basically intractable. And then the question is, how do, what do we do about this? Well, here, the approach that we have taken is to say we're still going to follow largely a decomposition type of approach, but what we want to do with the planning model is to have a model that integrates as much as possible some of the aspects of the scheduling models to try to minimize these mismatches. And this problem actually arose in the context of the following application, the Dow Chemical. So here you have various products A, B, and C, where, for example, product C is just simply a single step in a reactor that is placed in storage. Then you can have like a product A, where product A, some of it goes to storage, but some of it may be used to produce a product B. So A is used as an intermediate for this additional reactant. So basically, you could think this is a network where some involve one step or some processes involve two steps, and we have available a number of reactors that have to be scheduled over a given time horizon. Here, for convenience, we consider, let's say, a given number of weeks, where typically at the end of the week we have some due dates. So the problem essentially then here consists in one where you say, well, we have information on the raw materials, we have information equipment that is available and for of reactors, what are the batch sizes, the processing times which are given. And here the big challenge had to do with the sequence-dependent changeover times. Basically, the problem here is that, for example, when I switch from A to B, okay, we have to do some cleanup in the reactor and so forth. That may take, for example, 2 hours. But if I go from B to A, instead of taking 2 hours, it might take, say, 1 hour. Now, the impact of the sequence-dependent changeovers is not only that it makes the problem more difficult, but also it's very important to have some accurate estimation of it, because it translates really into lost capacity. The more changeovers you have, the less time you have really to produce useful products. And then, of course, again, we have the monthly forecast that we need to meet here. And the problem, the way to think about it in terms of a production plan, we want to determine how much do we produce of the various products, how much do we keep in inventory, how many batches will be produced. And especially one piece of information is really key, is the sequence of production. And the objective that we're taking here is actually an economic objective, because it's largely a planning problem. So the profit is sales minus the cost, cost including operating inventory and transition costs. Okay. Now, so just to give you a bit of a flavor about this problem, just wanted to show you this would be how a schedule would look like, for example, in the case where you have four reactors, R1, 2, 3, and 4, and six different products. So you can see here, like in reactor 1, we're producing three batches. We have this changeover time. We produce then four batches of each changeover, produce two products of E. Reactor 2 is, for example, all pretty much devoted to product A, and you can see that some of the material of F is placed in storage, and some of that is then used later to produce E, because, you know, F is an intermediate for product D, and it can be transferred also through the other line. So this is just to give you an idea physically what is it what we're attempting to do. Well, it turns out that this schedule was actually predicted by a very detailed mixed integer linear programming model. Now, I'm not going to describe it to you in detail, but I do want to give you at least a little bit of a flavor of what's involved. Again, the objective function is economic in nature. You can write it in terms of a linear function. These Z variables, as we'll see in a moment, are 0-1 variables. Then we have here assignment constraints. The W's, again, refer actually to assignments of products to the various reactors. Then we have detailed timing constraints. So this is like a changeover type of constraint, and so forth. And then the next set of constraints, believe me, the one thing that really complicates enormously is the transfer of material because of the timings. And that's basically shown in the next slide. And again, I'm not going to attempt to explain to you what's involved, but the message here is very clear. If I want to solve this problem for 1 week, fair enough, I might be able to do it. If I want to do this over 1 year, it's absolutely impossible. This problem simply becomes too large. So what we considered then here was to say, well, let's consider two types of models. First, sort of a higher level, more conceptual type of model. We call this a relaxed planning model. But simply what we do, we're going to underestimate the changeover times. In that way, for example, we just simply take the smallest for every pair. And then it's actually fairly straightforward to estimate, you know, what is the lower bound to the effect of the sequence-dependent changeovers. The problem, however, with that approach is that it gives us, if you wish, weak upper bounds. In other words, the profit predicted here is going to be too optimistic because the model was saying it can produce a lot more when, in fact, it cannot. So in order to overcome that, we consider this model B, which we call the detailed planning model. And here what we do, we say, well, we're not going to keep track of the detailed timings, but the one thing we want to keep track is of the sequencing constraints because they actually give rise to the changeovers. And as we'll see, this can actually be done by embedding within the modeling the model traveling salesman constraints. And the good thing about that, we can then obtain a much more realistic estimate of the profit. Now, again, we won't go into details of the models, but let me give you at least some of the highlights. So here we define a 0-1 variable, YP, is to assign products to units at each of these time periods. And B is how many times we produce that product, and FP is how much. In other words, the amount. Yeah. I'm sorry? In other words, the model B, as we'll see, will be a much tighter upper bound.
Tighter,
yeah. Tighter than model B. And in some cases, we'll see an example, you can actually, in some limiting cases, get exactly the same solution as the scheduling model. All right? Now, so here, defining the variables this way, for example, if we assign A to reactor 1 in time period 1, then that means this binary variable takes a binary of 1. There's three patches, as you can see here. If, for example, we're assigning B to the second reactor in time 2, then that means we have two patches and the corresponding binary variable is equal to 1. So these are sort of, let's call it, the high-level type of decisions. And what we want to do here is to couple them together with sequencing type of constraints. And the way we do this is by introducing these binary variables, ZPII prime, which is equal to 1 if product I is being followed by product I prime. And just to see how this works for a figure, if I start with product P1, if that's going to be followed by product P2, then this corresponding variable, ZP, is going to be equal to 1, and so forth. When I go to product 3 next, the corresponding binary variable. And in general, it turns out if I write down the assignment constraints of the traveling salesman problem, assuming that, you know, there's no sub to it, then I would get this closed cycle. Now, because we're interested in obtaining a sequence, we're going to introduce this variable, double ZP, which will be equal to 1 if we break any one of these links. So, for example, if we break the link between P3 and P4, if we activate this binary variable, then that will give rise to the sequence P4, 5, 1, 2, and 3, as is being shown here. Now, how do we actually model this problem? Well, it turns out all the various sequences that arise here, depending on where you break the link, can actually be modeled in the following form. The first two constraints here are really embedded assignment constraints. Usually, the YPs would be equal to 1. Then you get the assignment constraint of the well-known traveling salesman problem. The reason we replace the ones by the YP, because it depends whether or not we assign that product in the first place. Then here, again, we have the constraint that we can only break one link. And the other constraints that I have here just simply are included for the case, for example, when we have only one single product, then of course we have no cycle. And that's basically what is being reflected here. Now, in this way, what we're going to do, we add these constraints to our model, but we ignore the precise timing where the operations take place. Now, the problem, though, here is even when we go to large problem, we may find that, you know, that simplified model is still large enough. So what we're going to do here for large industrial application is to use a rolling horizon approach, where in the first time period you do the more detailed model B, the remaining time period you use the simplified model A. You make the decisions, say, for the first week, you fix them, you then move to the second week, and you apply this recursively until you cover the entire time horizon. Now, of course, if you do this, you're not going to guarantee optimality, but at least it's one, you know, way of overcoming, again, the large time for computation. Now, here, let me give you two examples. This is first a small example. The time horizon is just simply 1 week. We have only two reactors, and we have five products. So it turns out if you do the relaxed planning where we just simply underestimate the changeovers, it's very, very easy, we not unexpectedly overestimate the profit. So we're overestimating $1.68 million per year of profit. Now, it turns out when we use the detailed planning model, you can see we increase the problem size from 20 to 140 binary variables, from 50 to 200 continuous, from 60 to 300 equations. But the remarkable thing is when you compare that with the scheduling model, which in turn is 5 times larger than the detailed model and 10 times larger, or more than 10 times larger for the continuous variables, we actually get exactly the same objective function value. So what happens here? Well, what happens here, if you look at the various items like sales, operating costs, transition costs, inventory costs, you compare the ones with the detailed planning, the detailed scheduling, it turns out that both solutions are in fact identical. So we have an aggregate model that is able to reproduce the scheduling model exactly. Now, is that always going to be the case? Of course not. It turns out there are limiting conditions where we can show that this is true, and that's basically when every single product is performed in one step rather than in two steps, we can actually show that this is true. But let's move and see what happened with sort of the industrial size problem. The industrial size problem had 6 reactors. We had to produce 15 products and now over 48 weeks. So again, very long time horizon. In this case, you know, we could not solve actually the detailed model as such, so we had to use the rolling horizon, which you can see still gave rise to a rather large problem, 10,001 variables, 25,000 continuous, almost 30,000 constraints. But I think what's important here is again to realize that we used the simpler, relaxed planning model. That model is actually overestimating something like 20% the profit. So there's a huge gap. So going back to your question, so I'm not claiming that this is the absolute tightest, but I'm saying it's definitely much tighter than the simpler model. So that's the first application I wanted to show. And I want to switch here to the second application, which is motivated by questions of inventory. And the question here, statement here that inventory is everywhere. And one of the things that's interesting, it turns out in the U.S., it's estimated that inventory accounts for something like $1.4 trillion. And that something like 50% of it could actually be reduced, or at least that's what, you know, there is a claim. If that were possible, then of course, in principle, there is a great economic opportunity of saving of the order of $700 billion. But the question then here is, you know, what can be done to, you know, not fully realize this, at least but it partly accomplish that. So what we're going to look at here is something that we believe is kind of unique, which is trying to couple some typical, you know, supply chain design problems together with stochastic inventory. There's been usually that gap, and I'll explain in a minute why there has been that gap. It really boils down to the fact that supply chain design problems are mostly linear. As soon as you introduce stochastic inventory, it's nonlinear. So you end up with a mixed integer nonlinear optimization problem. So the specific problem we're going to be looking at here is one, we're given a number of manufacturing plants, let's call them suppliers, and we're given here a number of markets, we'll call them for simplicity retailers. The reason we're doing this, we're following here, this actually work that goes back to Dasking and his group, who were really the first ones who addressed specifically that problem. And the problem is essentially one where you postulate a potential number of distribution centers. You want to know how many of them you should place, and to whom they, to what markets they should serve. With an important point being here that each of these markets, you know, has some normal distribution for the demand. So there's uncertainty in the demand of these products. So then the problem here is, again, essentially we want to determine how many of the distribution centers we should place and what their location should be. Qualitatively, as we can see, it's going to be sort of a trade-off of that when we have fewer distribution centers, we can reduce actually the effective inventory that we use. But then the transportation costs may go up. So actually, it's usually better to distribute the distribution centers from the point of view of transportation, but then the inventory will go up. That's kind of an oversimplification of what we're going to be doing here. So basically, that's a major decision here. We'll also have to make some relatively detailed decisions on inventory. How many times are we going to replenish that over, say, 1 year? The reorder points, how much is going to be reordered? And at this point, we're going to neglect inventories at the level of retailers. So inventory is all going to be at the distribution center. And the way to think about it is, in a way, what we're trying to do is to sort of synthesize, you know, a network like this one, where the key decision variable is what distribution centers we should actually have. And the objective function will include here installation costs of distribution center, transportation costs, fixed order costs, work in inventory, and safety stock. So let me start first with the part dealing here really with the work in inventory and the fixed order costs. So this is sort of standard economic order quantity, so you have an expected annual demand. So here, mu, this is going to be the mean of the demand. We're going to multiply layers, we'll see, by a binary variable. We have items, cost for shipping, inventory, days per year, and so forth. The bottom line here is that the annual economic order of quantity cost consists of the ordering cost. This is a fixed cost. This is how many times you order to replenish the inventory per year. Okay. Then this is the transportation cost, which is any time, n times that you do a trip. And this function, V, is essentially a linear cost function as a function of the amount that you're shipping, which is the demand divided by n, all right? And then the last term, this is just simply the integral of the inventory d over 2n, which you multiply by h, which is the corresponding cost. And beta and theta are relative weight costs associated with transportation versus inventory, because that's the trade-off that we want to accomplish here. Now, it turns out that this is a nice function of n, the number of orders during the year. It's a convex function, so it's very easy here to just simply, you know, set up the stationary conditions and solve for the optimal number of orders. This would be, of course, for the deterministic case. And then that means that if you substitute that into the function for the cost function, this is basically the algebraic expression that you obtain. So we can obtain in a closed form solution the part of the working inventory. Now, but the other thing that we need to take into account here is the safety stock level. The idea here is, remember, we have some distribution function, and what we're going to do, we're going to specify some service level alpha that will give us the probability that we can meet the demand up to, let's say, this point. And specifically, what we're going to do here, so this is the mean mu, okay? And essentially, what we want to do here is to determine beyond the mean mu, what is the safety, additional safety stock that we're going to have in order to meet the demand. Of course, you know, if we have large inventory, we're going to be able to meet the demand, but that at the expense of having high inventory. If we keep the safety stock low, then of course we're going to have the risk of not meeting the demand. So we assume here, again, that we follow a normal distribution. And basically, it turns out you can easily show that the safety stock is here the normal univariate with the service level alpha multiplied by the variance. And that means what we're really saying, that the probability that the level B less or equal than the probability of alpha is equal to alpha. That's basically just simply the definition of the service level. Now, when we introduce the lead time, we're multiplying mu, which is a rate, so mu times lead time, this is the total amount, and we do the same thing for the variance. So this is, again, just simply to make the point again, it's easy to come up with a closed form expression for the safety stock in terms of the variance and the square root of the lead time. Now, one interesting thing about this expression that we've obtained here is a concept called risk pooling effect. What it means is the following. So the simplest thing that we could do is for every retailer, every marketeer, assign a warehouse or distribution center. And if we did that, then if we just simply add up the safety stock that would be required at each of the warehouses or distribution centers is simply given by the summation of the variances multiplied by the normal univariate at the level alpha. Now, what happens if instead of assigning a separate warehouse to each market, we assign, for example, just one, just like here? So let's assume we do it here. Well, it turns out if you do that, then actually it can easily be shown, all right, that the safety stock is going to be the square root of the sum of the variances, all right, of each of the expressions. And what that means is that very clearly the safety stock required in this configuration is going to be much smaller than the safety stock that I'm going to require for each of the warehouses, okay? So that we're going to try to incorporate in our expression. And here what I'm just simply showing, so what we're going to do then here, again, we're going to have, the demand that changes with time. It's uncertain. It's not going to always follow a given pattern. But the area in blue is going to represent the expression for the safety stock here that we have, which again is given by the expression of the sum of the variances. And here we multiply it by L, just as we did previously for the lead time. Okay? Now, so in order to model the problem, what we're going to do, we then have the set of retailers, which are really the markets. And then this should be small I, I'm sorry. And then we have the fixed cost for locating the distribution center, and this shipping unit cost from a given distribution center to a given market. So there's two types of binary variables involved here. The major one is xj to decide whether or not you install the distribution center. It's one if you do, zero if you do not. And then you have the yij, which is going to be equal to one if market or retailer I is being served by distribution center J. Now, if we put now everything together in a mathematical optimization model, this is basically, it's actually an integer nonlinear programming model. Let me explain briefly the various terms. Installation cost, this is just simply the fixed cost times the boundary variable xj, so this is linear. Then the next term that we have here is going to be the one of the transportation, which remembers the dij, which is the cost multiplied by the amount corresponding by the binary variable that connects I and j. Then the next term that we're going to have here is the one for the economic order quantity, which was given, if you remember, when we did the analytical derivation, the square root of an expression, plus this linear term. And then the last term is the one of the safety stock, which again I just showed you in the previous slide. And as you can clearly see, we have the square root of sums of y's, and that is clearly what introduces nonlinearities into the problem. Because the constraints here are actually quite nice and benign because they're linear. This is just simply stating every market I can only be assigned to exactly one distribution center. So the sum of yij is equal to one. And the second inequality here just simply states that if xj is equal to zero, meaning we do not build that distribution center, then the corresponding link also has to be equal to zero. In other words, if this distribution center is zero, it cannot serve, of course, any of the markets. Well, so it turns out, let me just show you first, you know, some results of this non, and again, by the way, this is a non-complex problem because the non-linearities that we have here involve summation of, the square root of summation of binary variables. So this is a non-complex problem. It turns out if we do a toy problem, if you wish, as we have here, where we have one single supplier with three potential distribution centers and six markets or six retailers, these are the solutions that we obtain. In this case, they were obtained with the software Baron. It was basically Global Optimizer in Baron. It actually gets solved fairly fast because the problem here is not too large. You can see that there is a balance between transportation and inventory. The model predicts two distribution centers, each serving three markets. If, on the other hand, transportation gets to be a lot more expensive, you go towards a more distributed type of configuration. On the other hand, if inventory gets to be larger, theta takes a larger value, you then do the pooling effect towards the distribution. So this is sort of showing the trend. Now, of course, we're interested now in solving these sort of toy type of problems, industrial problems, and I'm sure when Larry Megan gives his presentation, he will definitely give us an idea of the scale of some of these problems. So here, if we wanted, for example, to solve a more realistic problem that may have 150 potential distribution centers serving 150 retailers, we would require something like 22,000 binary variables. And very clearly, that problem would be totally intractable because it's a nonlinear integer programming problem. So what can we do about it? Well, basically, the first thing that we can do here is the following. So here, I'm just showing the model in a more compact form. So you can see the problem is linear here in the x and the y's. Here we have the square roots involving the weighted summation of the binaries in this term and in that term. And then we have the linear constraints. Now, it turns out one very nice and interesting property that you can show in this problem is that the binary variables y, I, j can actually be treated as continuous variables. It turns out that many of these 0, 1 variables can actually be treated as continuous variables. Okay? Again, I'm not showing the proof here because of time and so forth. But what is interesting also, if you look at this problem a little bit more carefully, if we were to actually delete the last two terms, this problem actually reduces to the uncapacitated facility location problem. That problem is in P-hard, but on the other hand, it's also known to have a very nice relaxation, very strong relaxation. Okay? So what we're going to do then is, in a way, try to take a bit of advantage of that. And basically, what we're going to do here is, because of the terms of the square roots, so again, we have this non-convex MINOP, what can happen numerically when you deal with them, like with a nonlinear programming problem, the gradients become unbounded when the variables take a value of zero. So what we're going to do here is a simple manipulation where we're replacing the square root here by the terms z1 and z2. And then what we do, we square the terms and write them in the form of inequalities in this form. Okay, so we place the terms of the square roots as constraints. And then basically you could think of it as this problem being a one with a linear objective function. All these constraints are linear except for these which are concave constraints. And these are responsible, if you wish, for non-convexity of the problem. But what we're going to do here is, because the problem is still fairly large, we're going to rely on a Lagrangian relaxation. And motivation here is going to be the following. If we look at the problem a bit more carefully, it turns out we can actually decompose the problem in terms of the distribution centers J, okay? And in effect, what we're going to do here, think of it that we're slicing, you know, the network horizontally here through each of the distribution centers. And basically what that means is that it's this constraint here that that we're actually going to dualize, because this becomes a sourcing constraint. So the constraint here that states that for every market, okay, you have to assign one single distribution center, that constraint is going to be dualized. So if you do that, if you place that in the objective multiplied by Lagrange multiply, it's usually done in Lagrangian relaxation, then the problem decomposes by distribution centers. And then at least, you know, there's hope, you know, for solving larger problems. Here I'm giving sort of the major steps involved. So you have initialization of the multipliers, you solve the various sub-problems. And here it turns out, depending on the value of the objective function, we may have to fix, you know, certain values of the binary variables, because it turns out, if I go back here, I'm not using here the freeze option, is that there is an implicit constraint, okay, that the for every market there has to be at least one distribution center that is active. So we're taking care of this through here. We then update the lower bound. So here, basically, what we're doing, we get the lower bound solving this problem, and then we fix the variable, solve a reduced NLP to get the upper bound, and hopefully if the bounds are within the limit, we stop, or if when we reach an iteration limit, otherwise we update the subgradient procedure that we're using here to update the multipliers. And again, this is sort of the standard Lagrangian relaxation scheme. Now, here I'm showing results for problems that involve 88 and 150 distribution centers. So here, the number of potential distribution centers is the same as the number of retailers. And it turns out, if you can see, remember, the 150 here involves 22,001 variables. Although, again, many of them can be treated at the end as continuous. But as you can see, what is remarkable here is that we can solve these problems with a very small dual gap. Now, this being a mixed integer problem, you know, we can never, theoretically, never close the gap, okay? But what we have found sort of computationally here is the fact that when we apply Lagrangian decomposition, we can actually be within, you know, fairly small gap of the optimal solution. And the computing times, by the way, here, you can see they range from 350 seconds, maybe the longest one, took like 40 minutes, 3,000 seconds, that would be the largest problem. In contrast, if you rely, for example, on a special a general purpose or resolver like Baran, you can see, you know, the gaps after 10 hours of computing time are still fairly large. Okay, and it turns out the solutions obtained here are quite a bit worse than the solutions that are being predicted by Lagrangian relaxation. So here, Lagrangian relaxation, you know, is actually provides a way of solving to near, I have to emphasize that, to near global optimality. It's not guaranteed global optimality. But let me just mention briefly, so I presented a problem that looks very much like a OR clean type of problem. It turns out that that problem can actually be extended to problems that are definitely related to the process industry. This one for polystyrene resins, this came from Nova Chemicals, where they had a given number of potential locations of suppliers, potential of plants for styrene. Then here in green, you know, in blue is the supply location, the green potential location of plants. Then here in gray, the distribution centers. And then in red is the actual customer location. So very much the same problem I presented before would apply here. The difference now being here that we have multiple products. And the other thing that we also consider here was actually two objectives. One was in an economic objective of maximizing the net present value. The other objective, we defined responsiveness as the lead time that is required to meet a given demand. Okay? So again, I'm not going to go into presenting this because of time limitation, but I just wanted to show you, just to give you an idea that the model I presented before, you can kind of extrapolate it to a much more complex situation like the one I'm outlining here. Now, at the beginning of the talk, I mentioned about the petroleum industry, how it's a very long supply chain, and it turns out there's many different problems, and I know here in Canada, petroleum is important, so that's why I thought I should also mention it. But for example, we looked at some problems with Petrobras at the supply chain, where you have production platforms and you have tankers that have to send the crude to you know, some of these refineries, how you coordinate the logistics. And conceptually, the problem here is that you deal with extremely large-scale mixed integer linear programming problems. Again, you know, there's that challenge, how you solve that problem. Also, working with Total on crude oil scheduling problems, where you have these vessels that arrive with different types of crude, they discharge them into storage tanks, they are then blended into these charging tanks, and then sent to the CDUs, the crude distillation unit. And it turns out this problem, conceptually, the difficulty involves the global optimization problem, mixed integer nonlinear, because of the bilinearities in the blending constraints. Another interesting problem here is this actually with BP, refinery planning problem, where beyond the CDU, you have the various units to produce the various grades of the gasolines. And here, the attempt is to go beyond the usual linear model. PIMS is a commercial product that's being used. It's all based on linear programming. The idea is, can we move and start introducing more accuracy into these models? But then that takes us to solving a nonlinear programming model. Now, but the application I really wanted to talk about, and this is the third application, again, it's related to petroleum, it's a collaboration we've had with ExxonMobil, again, deals with this problem of optimal development planning under uncertainty. So here, the situation that you have is that you have typically an offshore location where you have, you know, some reservoirs, and in the reservoirs you have a given number of potential wells where you tend to drill in order to extract the petroleum. And you're looking here, of course, at rather long time horizons, 10 to 30 years. And a big thing, as we'll see in a moment, of course, with investments that are, you know, very large. So what are the major decisions? Well, you need to decide how many and the capacity of these facilities, and I'll tell you in a minute what these facilities are. When are you going to install them? Because you might not want to do everything up front, because that's a problem under uncertainty. Do you invest everything from the beginning and then find out what is actually available in these reservoirs? So you need to also think of a schedule on how you're going to drill these wells, and then, of course, the production profile over time. Now, the big problem here is uncertainty, as you may imagine, okay? Because, of course, more and more it's becoming difficult to do these type of projects, so you don't know, for example, initial productivity per well, which means when you drill, how much is going to come out. What is the size of the reservoir? This really means how much is recoverable from the oil. Typically, these days, it's 40%, 50%, where we need to know that number. This also, the production of water, the water breakthrough time, as we'll see, that gets produced here. Now, to give you a little better insight on what are the options for the infrastructure, we're showing here two major alternatives that we consider. One are the so-called FPSO. This means floating point storage offloading. These are basically large oil tankers that have the capability of doing processing. So they can do, if you wish, separation here. Okay, so here, these are high capital costs and, of course, also have long construction time. The smaller ones tend to be actually converted oil tankers. Now, the second facility is the so-called tension leg platform, which is maybe the picture that's more familiar to you. And these are, as is shown here, when you have a tension leg platform, typically you drill just basically vertically down. With the FPSO, what is interesting is you can actually do the so-called subsea wells, where you go down and then you can actually go laterally and drill the wells. So it's much more complex in terms of the drilling, but then it's of course also much more flexible because you can reach these various different points. So the big issue here, so we need to make decisions. What are some of the investments that we should make when we have a project like this one? And of course here, what is absolutely key is some type of reservoir model. Now, as you might know, reservoir models are actually quite complex. They consist of, you know, large sets of partial differential equations, and I think we're going to tag them into an optimization model where we have discrete decisions, where we have stochastic variables. It's going to be absolutely impossible problem to solve. So the approach that we've done here is to say, well, we're going to extract some of these profiles from detailed simulations that are performed ahead of time. And here we're plotting the single oil water rate versus the cumulative production. So this will tell you the profile with time. And in blue, it would be the water breakthrough, how much is actually being produced as a function of time. Now, the way we're going to consider uncertainty here is through discrete distribution. So for example, we may take these two different sizes of the reservoir, one being 60% probability, the other one with 40%, with only two possible values. But what actually complicated the problem here is this idea of gradual resolution. So usually in stochastic programming, you assume there is uncertainty, the uncertainty gets revealed, and you immediately take some action. But here, we need to introduce delays in the sense initial productivity, we could only assume that it was known or revealed after we drilled at least three wells. If we drilled only one, the uncertainty would still be there. In terms of the size, it would mean that we'd only know it again after drilling nine wells or after producing 1 year. And then the one of the breakthrough time would be actually 1 year. So basically then the elements that we have a discrete time horizon, we have here discrete distribution, and of course that then gives rise to these scenario trees. So let me talk briefly about scenario trees, because another complication that we have here is that the uncertainties are so-called endogenous and not exogenous. And let me explain what that means. What it really means is that scenario trees in these problems will depend on the decisions, on the timing of the decisions. And let me explain you what that means. So suppose you invest in the field F in year one. And let's assume for simplicity, the uncertainty gets revealed after 1 year. So we find out we have high amount of reservoir, medium or low. Once that's revealed, the subsequent time periods, nothing will happen because it's already been revealed. But what happens if we delay the decision of investment? If we delay the decision of investment, for example, to year five, the first initial nodes, nothing happens, and then the tree will actually open up here in year five, which is when the uncertainty gets revealed. So a complication here is that the structure of the tree depends on the decisions. It's not given ahead of time. Okay? Now, very briefly, so when we deal with the scenario trees, this is typically the structure that we use. And the modeling challenge is how do you model variable trees? And the way we do that is actually through some nice work by Rosinski, where the idea is it turns out every tree can actually be represented through these sets of paths, where each path is a corresponding scenario. To see it more concretely, you can see this path from the tree, where you start with this initial node, go to time period one, time period two, okay, that would correspond to this path. And the idea is the way you can relate this representation to the tree is that the lengths that we have here are the so-called non-anticipativity constraints. What it means is that the state of this note, that note, that note, that note is the same. If they're all the same, it means it collapses to a single note. Okay? So this representation, what is nice, is by activating or deactivating these links, okay, we can change the structure of the scenario tree. Again, just so you can see that again more clearly, if I make a decision here at year one and then another one at year two, so here at year one I find two scenarios, I make another investment decision, so this would be the structure of the tree. But if I can postpone it for 1 year, okay, here nothing happens, here I find the two outcomes, and then when I do the decision here I have the two outcomes. So clearly I have two different scenarios, and the way these are generated is just simply with the Rosinsky representation by activating the corresponding links, and these are going to be given by so-called non-anticipativity constraints. Now, I'm only going to give you the general problem in words. So the problem is a multi-stage stochastic programming problem. It's multi-stage because we're doing decisions over stages. Objective is probability weighted for net present value. You have the various constraints. I would say the challenging constraints here are the so-called non-anticipativity constraints. We will actually write them as disjunctive constraints. So in other words, if a decision is taken, then we equate the nodes. If they are not taken, then basically we make them equal to zero. And here, just to give you again a flavor of the model, this I've written here to simplify it in linear form. We maximize the linear net present value. The constraints are for every time period and every scenario S. And you can see the challenge with a non-anticipativity constraint, you have to write them for every pair of scenarios S and S prime, because they have to be adjacent. And what it means is, if that is equal to true, we equate the variables, we collapse it to a node, or it's false, in which case nothing happens. So this relates then the state of the variable Z, okay, with the one of the investment decision. Okay? And very briefly, what we do here, we're going to relax these constraints, the logic constraints. The constraints that we have here are coupling constraints. We then actually dualize them, put them here in the objective function, and then basically it turns out the problem decomposes by scenario. So this problem can be solved for each scenario independently. It's going to be actually, in our case, a mixed integer nonlinear program. And then, of course, we want to find the summation will give us an upper bound. And to find the best upper bound, we're going to minimize it with respect to the multipliers lambda. Now, the way we solve this problem is actually through a branch and bound search. I'm just showing this for one of the examples. The thing I want to impress on you is that at each node, what we have to do is actually solve, you know, many of these mixed integer nonlinear programming problems for each of the scenarios, okay, because we're doing all these Lagrangian relaxation. So the relation of each of these nodes is actually rather expensive. Let me just give you briefly one example. This involves a single reservoir for 10 years. We have actually here a total of 8 scenarios because we're taking 2 values for productivity, 2 for size, and 2 for breakthrough time. These are the combinations of the values. And here are some rules that we're using of how many wells we can drill at a time and so forth. And this is the lead time for the construction, for the wells and for the facilities. Now, if you look at the solution of the stochastic programming, what it's doing is saying, well, given all the uncertainties, what we're going to do, we're going to install 2 small FPSOs and we're going to drill 12 wells at time zero. And then depending on the outcome, okay, after in year 2, which is sort of the lead time, if we find out that we were out of luck, we have low productivity, low size, we're just simply going to continue doing some drilling. On the other hand, if we have the most positive scenario, we have high amount, high productivity, we're going to install 5 additional 5 FPSOs and 3 tension leg platforms, and so forth. And this is the way it sort of keeps going and evolving, and it turns out the solution of that problem gives an expected net present value of $4.9 billion, okay? Now, what is encouraging here, we're comparing the solution of the stochastic program, because here, when you solve this problem, there's always the question, is it worth to solve it? Because, of course, it's, you know, a very large computation. So if you compare the solution in blue, the stochastic program, versus the red one, where we used mean values and did basically that same simulation, we find out, not surprisingly, that the stochastic program yields a higher net present value, 12% higher. But what's also more encouraging, and this is a nice byproduct, with the stochastic program, if you look at each of the aggregated scenarios, you find out that the net present value is always positive, whereas with the red one, actually, we get some negative values, which means that actually the solution of the stochastic program is also more robust in the sense of not reducing the financial risk. Now, again, not going here through the details, the initial version of the algorithm to solve this problem took 120 hours. We managed to reduce it to 5.2 hours, but it's, again, to give you a little bit of a flavor, the challenges that are involved here. Now, let me then conclude by saying I hope that, you know, what I've conveyed here is the idea that enterprise optimization is definitely an area that is of great industrial interest, and especially it has clearly great economic impact. The second key point is, of course, that planning and scheduling in these problems plays a crucial role, so there's a challenge of modeling, and I would say especially conceptually what's interesting is the multi-scale type of challenge, how you model the problem. And I think the third application, I think, also shows very clearly that computationally, well, we have, of course, large-scale problems already in some of the deterministic problems, but when we go with uncertainty, these problems become even larger. So I think there's a good thing. There's a lot of scope here for, you know, developing, you know, better algorithms and faster methods for solving these problems. Okay? So with this, I'd like to thank very much for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.